This is Brian Rashid Global coming to your local device. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of BTV. We are here with the one and only Robin Arzon. Is that right?
Yeah, you got it.
Boom.
You got it.
Boom. So, Robin is a superstar, New York Times bestselling author, personality, influencer, amazing woman all across the board. We reached out to you on Instagram. Thank you for accepting the invitation to come onto the show. You really make me feel lazy, and that is like that is an incredible thing, so thank you for that. Robin, before we get into your story, I just want to thank Facebook Live for watching. I want to thank our amazing team for doing the transcription, for doing the video, for doing the Facebook Live, and for you sharing your goodness with all of these amazing people that are watching. Thank you for all of you that are watching as well. Robin, before we get into what it takes to become a New York Times bestseller, what it takes to run 5 consecutive marathons in 5 consecutive days, and more importantly, what it takes to run 100 miles at once. Was that all at once?
Yeah, 29 hours. It's so crazy when
I'm done.
It's so crazy.
Before we talk about all those things, tell us a little bit about who you are, where you come from, and what was the driver behind this life of yours?
Well, I didn't run my first mile until I was in law school. I actually was a practicing lawyer for 7 years in New York City, and I actually loved it. I loved the part.
What kind of law did you do?
I was a corporate litigator, and then I dabbled in a little bit of IP as well. This was during subprime, like the markets were crazy. It was a really stressful time, I think, to work in anything related to finance, but I kind of liked that friction. Even though, frankly, the SEC regulations and other subjects were mundane, I loved the intellectual rigor of the job, but I did find myself counting down the hours until I could leave the office and run, even if it was like at 10 p.m. for 30 minutes.
Was that the first time? So was this the first time that you were like, oh, there might be something here?
Yes, and I didn't run my first mile until I was in law school, and that was actually to deal with a traumatic hostage incident that happened to me when I was in college.
In the East Village.
In the East Village, yeah. So I was entering my senior year at NYU, and I was held hostage by a man with a gun in a wine bar in the East Village. Totally random. And that, obviously, traumatic experience kind of, I think, set a different trajectory for me, because I felt like I needed to move through the trauma in ways that traditional therapy and things didn't accomplish. And the running my first mile, and then my first 10K, and then signing up for my first marathon, and then I just kind of continuously raised the bar. And my running and law kind of went in parallel tracks until I just ran right out of a law career. So I started increasing my distances, decreasing my pace, and here we are.
So when you were held as a hostage in the East Village, which, you know, for all of our friends in Las Vegas, like, this is obviously a very timely topic. It's scary what's happening in many parts of the world. But when did running come into your mind during that process? Were you like, oh my God, I'm hostage, all I want to do is like run?
No.
Or like, what happened?
It actually happened, I would say, like, it marinated probably for like a year. I literally didn't run my first mile until law school. Mm-hmm. I joked that I was allergic to fitness. I like would forge notes to get out of gym class. Sorry, Mom. And it really wasn't part of my story. Like,
sorry,
it really, I was intimidated, honestly, by considering myself an athlete.
Why do you think that was?
It's just not something that I ever did. I was the arts and crafts kid. I was the kid that got straight A's. And of course there are many people who do all of that at once and excel in sports, but that's not something that I even allowed to enter my mind. And I do believe that I just didn't identify really with any of the public figures at the time. You know, it was like the Chicago Bulls and Michael Jordan, and you know there were female athletes around, but it wasn't really part of the conversation, at least not one that I was part of.
Were you born and raised in New York?
I was born in Philadelphia and raised outside of Philadelphia.
Okay. And then at what point did you come to New York? For law school?
I came, no, for, to attend NYU, so for college.
For college, okay. Now, the running starts, and you're starting to feel this. At what point did you say, this is actually what I want to become my thing, my full-time job, my world?
Well, that really came about with influencer marketing. It was, you know, these platforms are mushrooming, and brands are paying money to people on the internet and on apps for things. And honestly, things changed when I stopped accepting free shoes. Hmm. It was like, I'm not accepting free shoes, you're paying my rent. And that's when things changed.
Cool. So what was the first you're paying my rent thing that came to you?
It was really like twofold. I was talent on camera, you know, just in an ad campaign or things like that. And behind the scenes, this was much more interesting for me. I had a lot of consulting gigs. So okay. I just started charging brands an hourly rate to consult for the meet for coffee, pick your brain. I was like, sure, we can do that. And this is my hourly rate for that.
And what did they want to meet with you about?
Usually it was about like, this was, I guess, considered the third wave of running 5-6 years ago, really getting to the urban athlete, maybe the person who wouldn't consider themselves a casual jogger, but also isn't a marathoner. So running is now a lifestyle for a lot of 20-somethings, 30-somethings, yep. And this was really that tipping point.
Yep.
And I was running with a crew, the original New York City run crew, Bridge Runners, and that was very robust and dynamic and organic. And then brands started piping up like, oh wow, you guys might be onto something here.
Okay, so a lot of people want to know how to become an Instagram influencer. A lot of people think, you know, I'm shocked at how many people think this thing happens just like quickly.
That's so insane.
Right? So tell us about the process of like when you started producing content, creating content around this running lifestyle, and how long did you create content before you started to see these opportunities come to you?
So I started a Tumblr literally just as a scrapbook for me for my own first marathon journey. I signed up for the New York City Marathon after a breakup, and I just wanted to document that
process. A little
less
dramatic than a hostage.
I mean,
well, maybe, I don't know. Maybe not.
It was very much so less dramatic. Everything is in context, man. But it became just something that I started doing. It's like I'd go for a 20-miler and I'd capture that. And it really was just so I could look back. And I didn't know if I was going to be one and done, right? So I was like, if I'm only going to run one marathon, I want to be able to look back at 70 posts that make me proud.
Yep.
And then I
so you did it for yourself.
I did it for myself.
That's cool.
And then I crossed that first marathon finish line and I was like, okay, I have the bug. Like, this is about to become something for me.
Yep.
Nobody was paying attention. Nobody knew who I was for years. I mean, years.
And are you creating content throughout all of these years?
Yeah.
And the content,
almost daily.
The content is what? It's you, it's scenery, like what is the content?
So it initially, Tumblr is more, it's a visual medium, but it was traditionally like more like a new platform for blogging. So I did toy with, sort of daily entries, more like diary entries. But then once Instagram hit, it really became just a visual conversation, my visual conversation with the world. And it was through that platform that I realized, oh, like my point of view might be a little bit different. Like not everybody wears four finger rings to go run a marathon. Not everybody has like rib tattoos and wears red lips, you know? And I was like, oh, this is cool. Like, and not only am I being accepted by the running community in real life, I'm now having virtual training partners around the world. And then I started going to races and visiting crews and people that I had only known on Instagram, and then things just started to grow, and it was like consistent posting, authentic messaging, real storytelling.
Yeah.
And I tell people like, oh, how do you develop content? I'm like, if you are living the thing that you're passionate about, you are never gonna have any. You're always gonna have the ability to post authentic and real content.
Yes, that's cool. So then the transition into an influencer, right, was happened at how many months or years in before you started to get people saying like, hey, we need you to do something for us?
I just inserted myself into the conversation. Like 2 weeks, the tipping point for me actually quitting my law job was the London Olympics were coming up. I had asked for an extension. I took a 5-month leave of absence just to dabble in this world. That was coming to an end. the law firm was like, you're in or you're out. We love you, but you're in or you're out. 2 weeks before the London Olympics, quit my job, went with a cracked iPhone, standing next to CBS and NBC, just trying to, elbowing my way to interview athletes. And I was just posting stuff, like just getting it out there. Not even knowing who was paying attention. And then from there, I ended up actually getting an agency gig working on the with Nike Women's on the agency side. So Nike Women was my client. And I worked with them on some of their platforms. Learned very, very quickly that I didn't want to, I wanted to collaborate with brands, but I never wanted to be subsumed by their brand. So, and it was that point that, you know, I think I had amassed maybe at that point, maybe like 7,000 followers on Instagram.
Interesting.
But just enough to like be part of the conversation. Definitely not a seat at the table where, you know, things are happening, but I was bold enough. And it was like, it was that second jump off the cliff. Yep. It was actually less, it was more scary that second time. Leaving law, I was like, I'm sure. Leaving the agency gig into the ether of God knows what, and just like really peddling for a paycheck, that was scarier. The second round was scarier.
And how many, have you had other rounds since then?
Yeah, what, I mean, it's a circuitous process, but I mean, at this point, I'm very, very lucky that I have really established relationships with certain brands, and I actually, you know, I have an agent at WME, so like things have really, really developed a lot greater.
So so I know you're working with Equinox, and I saw a couple of other brands. What other brands are you working with that you're really proud of?
That's historically. So I did work with Equinox. So right now, I am a global ambassador for Adidas.
Yep.
I'm vice president and head instructor at Peloton, which is a cycling company.
Tell people what that is. Because the first time that I was exposed to it was because of you.
Oh, well, welcome.
Welcome to the family.
Yep.
It's an awesome, awesome concept.
Yeah, well, Peloton is a technology company that produces fitness content. So we have a bike that people can ride with us and live stream 14 to 16 hours of live content a day. So I am one of the instructors. When you tune in, you see me on stage, you have metrics on your screen, so you
and
can
it's
be
like
accountable.
A party. It's a party,
but it's also a really athletic experience.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a leaderboard, you are so accountable for your journey on the bike because it really is all about you. It's 45 minutes for somebody to be selfish. And I think you leverage community and amazing, the best hardware, the best bike on the market, with incredible software, boom, it's a wrap.
And how did you get involved with that?
I entered group fitness, honestly, as a hobby. I was kind of lulled in between these influencer marketing gigs, which like there were months where I was just like, is this even gonna happen? So I was like, maybe I need a little something that's
steady. What do you
mean
is this even gonna happen?
Well, because there would be, let's say I'd get a modeling gig or a consulting gig and that would be a few months.
Yep.
But then I might go 6 weeks and nobody's biting and pitching articles and I was just wearing every hat, planting every seed, and it's only now that things are really starting to bloom. But there were months where I was like really second guessing myself.
Yeah.
So I entered group fitness. I'm obviously passionate about wellness, but I'd never really done it in an instruction as an instructor.
Yep.
And I was teaching at a local studio in Union Square. I read an article in Fast Company about John Foley, the CEO of Peloton. Yeah. And I was like, you know what? Like, your vision is aligned. I want a global platform. I want to be with the best technology company in fitness. And here I am.
And so what does that look like? What does your role with Peloton look like right now?
So I'm vice president of fitness programming. So yeah. I work hand in hand with the production team to develop all of our content offerings. I'm the lead for recruiting our instructors and kind of maintaining the roster of instructors that we have. I teach.
Cool. When you're looking for instructors, because perhaps people out there that are watching this right now might be interested, what does an instructor need to qualify to be an instructor with you guys?
Honestly, it's a really small bullseye. It's not just, you know, we have a lot, there are a lot of gorgeous fit people in the fitness community, but it's not just teaching a credible and authentic and athletic fitness experience. It's hosting a television show at the same time. So we actually have found in recruiting that it's usually word of mouth. We don't really host any open calls or anything like that. And it is a narrow bullseye. So I'm very, very proud to say that I teach alongside the best instructors in the industry, and it's because it requires, frankly, so much more. When you have five cameras, you're dealing with a leaderboard of 600 people, including the 59 people in the room. A producer, you know, flagging you to let you know something. You've got messages flashing on your screen. I'm proud to say that it's tough, but it should be tough because we have a really high bar.
Now there are so many things to talk about here, but like at what point did you say I want to write a book? Where did the book come in? So it's so funny to hear
book.
Like you yeah. really when you say like you're wearing all these hats, like you literally were wearing like a lot of different hats.
Yes.
The book you wrote. It then became a New York Times bestseller. Like, what was that process like? And where was it, you know, I know it's like, it's, how did it happen?
That process was accelerated almost by fate because I was joining a show with National Geographic called Migrations where I trekked through the Serengeti. So I trekked through 200 miles of the Serengeti for National Geographic. I was leaving, I had just gotten a book agent, May. Leaving to film the show in June.
Yep.
I give her the keys to the kingdom. I said, like, sign the deal, whatever the deal is, I'll take it. I come back in August after 6 weeks in the Serengeti, and she was like, you have until October 15th to write this book. So it... She's like, HarperCollins just bought your book. You better write it now. I literally only had 3 months.
What did you pitch them? What was the pitch?
The classic book proposal, 10, 12 pages. It was kind of a mix. You know, a lot of my book has visual imagery. It has imagery in it.
Yes.
So it was a mix of, it was kind of my Instagram plus 5,000 to 8,000 words, right? So sample chapters, of course,
yep.
Market competitors, table of contents. It's kind of like this, a little bit of a fleshed out skeleton.
Yep.
But in this day and age, it also involves the personality of the author. Because I think, you know, book publishers are realizing they're going to get more sales if they're aligning with a personality.
Sure.
At least in nonfiction.
Yeah. And so, okay, so you pitch HarperCollins, they say yes. Now you have 6 weeks to write a book or 8 weeks to write a book. What was going through your mind at this point? Like if you thought to yourself, I want my book to do one thing, what was that thing?
For me, it was to demystify running. There is so much technology and shoes and just stuff. And it's like, it's not that complicated. Lace up and decide how badly you want it. And I think like, it's just being, and also, it's not only unpacking running, but also being unapologetic in your approach to running. I think that there are so many different ways for people to feel really proud about towing the start line, and I want to create a support system for that.
Interesting. And so then you write the book. What, if anything, how did that play into your brand? Like what changed for you after you had a published book?
Definitely more opportunities for things like speaking engagements, but from a community perspective, which is frankly more important to me, is actually just seeing how this, for some people, it's whether it's their first mile or their 1,000th, seeing how my book can be part of their running journey, which is honestly, it's insane to
me. How have you found most commonly that your book becomes a part of someone's running journey?
Oftentimes, it's somebody's first 5K, somebody's first 10K, first marathon.
And it's like, I read your book, you helped me to just start.
I just signed up for this race,
I just did it.
And then, of course, I find really encouraging folks who were like, man, I rediscovered my love of running from this book. I haven't run in 20 years, or I'm rehabbing an injury, and this is what I'm doing. And that kind of aha moment, that awakening, is like what running's all about.
And so you started, you know, first mile in law school, and then you've run. I mean, when I read that you ran five consecutive marathons in 5 days... Now, mind you, Richard, if you're watching, one of my best friends' name is Richard, and he's running his fourth marathon this weekend in Chicago.
Nice, good luck.
Good That's luck, awesome. Richard. And I've been to every one of his marathons so far. In fact, I surprised him in Berlin at the finish line.
Oh, I just ran Berlin.
You did? Mm-hmm. Last September?
No, or, last Sunday.
Oh.
Last
Got
week.
It. Got it. Clearly, I need to lace up a little faster. So, but I see him after his run, and he, like, you know, is a zombie, and he can't move, and then the next day there's, like, some soreness. Sorry, Richard, for putting you on blast. But, like, you ran five marathons in five consecutive days, and you've also, at one point, run 100 miles consecutively. correct?
Right, that's correct.
So how? Seriously, like how?
To be honest, training for an ultramarathon, which is a distance anything farther than a marathon, is really just about back-to-back long runs. You add one extra long run a week. Of course, your weekly mileage will increase, but you know, I don't want to bore you with the minutiae of it, but doing back-to-back long runs, and it is the mindset of a warrior. Like, that's what attracts me to ultras, is that there is no BS. You will see who you are at mile 70 of a 100-mile ultramarathon in a way that, like, there's no therapist chair, no partner, no job could ever get you to that point. And that's how. You have to want it bad enough.
Do you have would you consider yourself to have an extreme personality?
Yes.
Yeah. So, like, so many questions about a 100-mile run. Let me just ask you a question that I selfishly want to know. What was, like, the craziest thought that you had during that 100-mile run? Where you were like, oh my God, I can't believe I just thought that.
So I was running point to point from Key Lager to Key West, and there's a 7-mile bridge. And I was running just with a headlamp. It's probably midnight, just me. There were no runners, no support, because there's no, there were no shoulders on the road. So you couldn't even have, like, people meet you anywhere. And I was like, what if I just run off this bridge? Like, what if I just run off this bridge? Like, into the wall, like, just a really—
Like, you wanted to, or you were afraid of it?
Like, I was afraid, what if I just get so disoriented and I just veer off, you know? And you're.
And what did you do? What was the next
thing? I just kept focusing on the light 2-3 feet in front of me and just going towards it. Going towards the light. Yeah, it was freaking insane. I mean, people do tend to hallucinate in ultramarathons.
Yeah, I'm sure. Like, I hallucinate when I run like half a mile.
Yeah, so, it's like an out-of-body experience.
Okay, so this is really cool. And then in terms of going back to the book for a second, were there any, because we have people that write and that watch the show, was there any, what tips would you give someone that either wants to write a book? So let's just do it in three parts. Number one, I want to write a book. What should I do to start? Number two, should I self-publish or should I go with a publisher? Mm-hmm. And then number three, how do I get to the point of becoming a New York Times bestseller if I go with a publisher? Or if I self-publish, how can I really get it out there? Because I know a lot of people that write books and then, you know, no one reads them.
Yeah.
So let's start.
Well, you gotta write it first. For me, I actually found this writing the book proposal was really, really helpful. I mean, sometimes that might be putting the cart before the horse, but having a little bit of a skeleton to then flesh out gave me guidance. So I literally carved out in my schedule, made calendar appointments with myself, that it was like, this is chapter one, this is chapter two, and maybe chapter one, and they're taking a little longer than I anticipated, or I'd blaze through, you know, 20 pages and not get up from my desk. And the calendar appointment was like a non-negotiable meeting with myself. So whether it was, and I tend to have them in 90 minutes of productivity.
Okay.
So I would schedule like 3-4 hours and kind of not let myself up for 90 minutes, take a breather, and then revisit. So it's like 3 hours of real work in like a 4-hour time span. But that calendar appointment, the consistency, and having something in it to kind of keep you accountable, whether it's by chapter or topic or theme or whatever, character, if it's a fiction book. The second part of your question was?
So that's great advice. Number one, if you want to write a book, just write a table of contents, even if it's loose. Number two, how did you choose between self-publishing and getting a publisher?
I didn't actually have to make the choice. I actually
you
was really,
it and then they got,
I was
they gave
really
it.
Lucky to have,
what
to have
would
a
you,
publisher.
What would you, did you enjoy, I mean, did you enjoy that experience? If you were to do it again, would you have self-published or would you have gone with the publisher? In retrospect.
It was great. I mean, honestly, having an editor that's sort of aligned with you on your team, having the team of HarperCollins, like,
and
have
my
back. I mean, it's a big,
the best.
It's a big,
it's one of
big,
the best.
It's a biggie, you know, so that's, no question about it.
So you were cool with the publication. And then how do you market a book? How did you personally market it? How helpful was HarperCollins in the marketing process? If you were to self-publish a book, let's say, what would you do now? I mean, you have 100,000 followers on Instagram. What if you have 5,000 followers?
Well, this is where it was honestly so part and parcel with social media, is that I really told my existing community about it. And then, of course, Harper got it in many more stores and press started picking up. So that's where things kind of expanded. But my initial, like, pre-order was definitely just my existing followers and social leveraging social media like you would any other way. Yeah. I would say for someone with a smaller social media following, or anyone, frankly, is really just try to get it into the hands of people you respect and people who write about the things that your audience cares about.
That's smart. So did you had existing relationships with bloggers, yeah, and vloggers, yeah, in the running and health and fitness space?
Exactly.
Okay, so next question I want to ask you is, do you ever get sick?
Sick, like,
yeah,
ill?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah?
But not very often.
Have you found that since you started running, your immune system has built into, or have you always been someone that didn't get sick very often?
Well, it's funny because I was actually diagnosed as a type 1 diabetic, right, about 4 years into my running. So that was obviously came as a shock. My pancreas just doesn't produce insulin. But besides that very huge chronic condition, I am actually in the best shape of my life. And
you look very strong.
I'm pretty strong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would definitely not mess with you. I would definitely not mess with, I actually would try to fight Nick before I try, and Nick is pretty big. I would try to fight Nick before I try to fight you, for sure.
It's, it feels good to be able to push and pull your own body weight. I always tell people, take up more space, man. Just take up more space. Like, the world needs you.
Take up more space. I love that.
Yeah.
That and run towards the light. You're giving us, I'm basically going to write an entire New York Times bestseller about this interview. So, type 1 diabetes is, from a logistical standpoint, if you're running 100 miles, how does the diabetes play into that?
Oh my God. I mean, being a type 1 diabetic is like a tightrope walk. You are constantly negotiating how much insulin, little insulin, how many carbs, what are you eating? And that's 24 hours a day. It's like having a child or a pet. You don't forget that thing exists. It is a huge layer onto in my running. I mean, already you're very, the good thing about being an endurance athlete before I was diagnosed is that I was always very, very self-aware of how I'm eating, how I'm feeling, very in tune with my body.
Yep.
And now I use that skill set to inform how I can run a 100-mile race when my blood sugar's dipping, when I'm going too high, when I use technology, I use a pod that I had to rip that off during the Tokyo Marathon because it failed and it was alarming. You know, crazy things happen, but I do same way I approach ultra marathons. I approach my type 1 management as opportunities to be stronger. Like every single day, I'm like, okay, you're even more of a badass because you just dealt with this, and people didn't even wake up yet.
Everything you're saying is super impressive. Now, you're an early riser?
I am. Not naturally. That's been just by habit over
the
years.
Oh my God, please tell me. Because
I'm not naturally.
Teach me. Because I really, with all of my heart, want to be an early riser. And it's so hard for me to get out of bed before 7:38.
That's your natural clock. I mean,
it is. Actually, my natural clock is stay up until 2, sleep till 10.
Oh, damn.
Like, I crank best from 8 p.m. to 2 a.m. Oh. But since we have a team and an office and all these things, I have to...
No, I get it. It's not practical.
For all the people, and there's a lot of people out there that say, I'm a night owl, but I have to be in an office in the morning. What do you tell them?
The number one way to develop a morning workout routine is to have an accountability partner. Like literally have somebody who's waiting for you at 6 a.m. or sign up for a class and you know the instructor or you paid money. It's like, why are you gonna waste your own money? A trainer, that kind of thing. It's like start with 6 weeks of every Wednesday morning at 6 a.m. we do this thing. And that will at least get you out of bed and you will be tired initially, especially if you are more of a night owl.
Yeah.
But once you're realizing that you're feeling so much more productive and so much more energized throughout the day, it's gonna be worth getting to bed by getting that extra hour of sleep.
Yeah. All right, so a couple of different philosophical questions for you. What drives you in your life right now?
I have a healthy fear of failure. I think that I establish really high bars for myself and I'm never satisfied.
Yeah.
And I think that there is a champion mindset that hunger always exists a little bit.
Yep.
And for me, one of my biggest challenges is balancing feeling really content and pleased and proud with what the next finish line is.
Yep.
And I don't really I live as if there is no finish line, but it's like you should take a moment and marinate in what you did. So that balance is a little tough for me.
And how do you stretch it? How do you handle that balance right now? Do you have any daily things built in?
I have like little gratitude moments. I set alarms on my phone to kind of remind me to, like, you know, little pithy things that kind of remind me to stay grounded. And, you know, I have people in my life, my mom, my fiance, that are just like have really positive and really have that kind of, like, I don't know, energetic frequency that kind of keeps me like neutral.
Yeah. Okay. And then what are your next finish line goals right now?
I've got 6 months.
If we sit down 6 months from now and you've said, I've done these things, it's been a good 6 months, what are these things?
Well, from a racing perspective, I'm training for another 100 miler. I've got a few more marathons this fall. Always striving to get faster.
By the way, I've got a few more marathons this fall. Like, I love it how casual you are. Again, 1 mile, I think I'm going to die. Like, die. Dead.
That's so relative.
So bad.
I need to shift that perspective, man.
No, I know. It's true. All right, so you have a few more.
We're
talking about you right now. We have a few more marathons to finish this fall. You're training for a 100 miler. Where's the 100 miler going to be?
Back in the Keys. Yeah, back in the Keys. I'm going to revisit that same course, try to break 24 hours.
We all have to have goals.
Just
run for 23 hours straight.
Yeah.
Don't ever complain about working 10 hours a day, any of you.
Yeah, don't complain.
So, what else?
We keep building the Peloton team. I'm really excited about some initiatives that we have coming up.
That's a full-time thing for you?
Yeah, so that's full-time. I mean, I have like 3 full-time jobs.
What are the other ones?
For me, it's...
Adidas?
Yeah, I would say like at modeling and things, that's kind of one bucket, which includes Adidas. Then there's Peloton, and then there's my own... I might not be winning races, but I consider myself a professional athlete, and I train 30 hours a week.
I consider myself a professional athlete. I run 100. Yeah, I would say you're a professional athlete.
So those are the 3 buckets. It's kind of like my public-facing PR campaign stuff, Peloton, and then my own training.
What's the big vision 10 years from now when we're sitting here? I mean, if you have one.
I definitely have one. I really want to be known as someone who got people off the couch to do epic shit. I think... Every layer of my brand, whether it's associated with Peloton or Adidas or not, that's the core of my being. I will still be doing that in a decade.
What's the thing that you're most proud of about yourself?
I am most proud that I always get back up. Mm. I would sooner die than be defeated. Mm.
Who's the most influential? I mean, can we do like 5 rapid
questions?
Totally. Most influential person in your life right now?
My mother.
Why?
She is a real life superhero.
Why? One line.
She is resilient as hell, and I'm so glad I got her genetics.
Yeah. All right. Biggest frustration you have in your life right now?
Diabetes, for sure.
Best book that you've gifted to the most amount of people?
Ooh.
Aside from your own.
Finding Ultra by Rich Roll. Okay. I've given that away a lot. And Rich is a friend of mine, so hi, Rich.
Cool. Hi, Rich. The thing that you think you do better than anyone else?
Get back up. It's a mindset.
Mm-hmm. The moment in your life that was the most impactful for you so far?
Honestly, probably being held hostage, because it was like at a really young age, and it gives you perspective like that. Like, there's no misunderstanding of purpose when you survive something like that. Like, I was like, this is not my story. What is my story? Okay, let's go write that. And that's what happened.
Cool. Okay, so any final thoughts that we'd like? I mean, first of all, Shut Up and Run, awesome. Definitely highly recommended. I actually need to like get into it. I started to read it and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Santa loves it. I need to get into it. So Shut Up and Run, amazing. We'll link all of your social in the description. What else would you like to share with people that are watching just about a message or a thing that you want, you know, to have the audience remember?
Stop apologizing. Stop apologizing for being new, for asking for attention, for asking for a meeting, for getting, you know, stop apologizing. It's like we live in a world of no. We live in a world of like, I think, just this pervasive culture of no and limiting beliefs. So like, stop apologizing for who you are. Take up more space and keep doing the damn thing.
Take up more space. I love that. I love that. Take up more space. Keep looking for the light. Building. So, last question for you. I keep saying last question, but it's like there's so many things I want to ask you. 103,000 followers on Instagram. Do you care about that?
I absolutely pay attention to it. I mean, that I've been able to monetize that.
How did you go from like, do you remember going from like 100 followers to like 1,000 to like 10,000? Like, what is the six? What is this? The recipe? Everyone wants to know, how do I get a big following? How do I get a big following? How do I get a big following? What was your recipe for a big following on Instagram?
It's posting consistent content that people care about. And I do think that there is a natural growth from there. I planted so many seeds. I mean, it was like, and I didn't actually actively try to increase my following at all. It mm-hmm. really happened organically. Mm-hmm. But you have to plant a lot of seeds. You have to like approach it on many different levels. So it was approaching wellness, not just from following people that I respected, but it's also maybe engaging communities that like you could also be a leader. So it's like reaching high and reaching low, and then and reaching to sort of people in the marketplace that you would consider your equals. That's from press, that's from networking, that's, you know, posting interesting stuff, commenting on people's things. It's like engage, like lean into it.
Yeah.
And it's not just all about like hashtag campaigns and like,
right,
all this other...
Like, it's actual work.
It's actual work. If you don't approach it like a job, minimally an hour a day, then you're just fooling yourself.
An hour a day, wow.
Yeah, I would say it's an hour a day. If you really want to increase your following, it's minimum an hour a day.
Yeah, minimum, right. I was going to say, hour seems low. So, that, I mean, that's amazing. So, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been a lot of fun. We're going to link up your social stuff. I'm not going to tell you that I'm going to go out and run, but you've definitely inspired me to go out and do cool shit. Hope you guys are inspired to get up off the couch and do cool shit. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Have a great day. Guys, it's your hour, it's your life, it's your dream. Go get it, because if you don't, nobody else will. Thanks for watching, guys. Ciao. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please check me out on all of the social worlds, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, and YouTube at Brian Rashid Global. See you there.